Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by ReaderViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I'm talking with award-winning author Will Hutchison about his new book, Follow Me to Glory. This is a new novel, and it's a historical fiction set during the Crimean War. So before I introduce Will, let me tell you a little bit about him. Will Hutchison is a graduate of Syracuse University with 26 years as an officer in the U.S. Army and Marine Corps. He has spent his life in interesting and often dangerous endeavors, from leading Marines in Vietnam to working as an undercover drug agent in Amsterdam with military CID, to serving as a federal special agent conducting fraud investigations and counterterrorism initiatives at nuclear plants. He resides in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where he pursues his writing and photography with occasional law enforcement consulting projects. As an avocation, he has written and lectured on 19th century military history internationally for over 20 years. So I'm so happy to have Will Hutchison on the phone today. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live, Will.
Thank you, Juanita. I appreciate the opportunity.
Great, great. Yes, I'm so happy to talk with you. This is a very fascinating book, Follow Me to Glory, and it takes place during the Crimean War. And for our listeners that aren't familiar with this war, would you give some backstories to where it was, who fought it, the significance of it?
Actually, I find that most people know more about the Crimean War than they realize they know.
Hmm.
It's Florence Nightingale, the Lady with the Lamp, Errol Flynn charging in the charge of the Light Brigade, the Thin Red Line, they all came from the Crimean War. It took place between 1854 and 1856, basically on the western coast of the Crimea, which is today's Ukraine.
Okay.
It involved an awful lot of political mystery and intrigue, some bogus religious reasons, but basically it was Russia and their visions of expansion trying to gain a warm seaport for trade routes between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. The religious reasons were the immediate cause, and the catalyst was that Russia invaded the Ottoman Empire, Turkey. And when they invaded Turkey by treaty, Britain and France, who at that time were very strange bedfellows.
No kidding.
And the Italians, which were then the Sardinians, came to the aid of Turkey. What had actually happened was that Turkey itself and their army stopped the Russians and basically caused them to go back into Russia, and the war was pretty much over.
Over? That seems quick.
It was way too quick for the British and the French, whose people were outraged at the time, and they had other ulterior motives, but they decided this was too quick, and that they needed to teach Russia a lesson, hopefully to stop them from having visions of expansion in the future. And that lesson was that they would capture Sevastopol in the Crimea and sink the Black Sea fleet, which was not as easy as it apparently sounded at first, because it took them several years to capture Sevastopol, and in fact the Russians sunk their own fleet in order to stop ships from coming into the harbor.
Oh, wow.
And after 2 years of a, 3 years of a very, very difficult war, totally mismanaged war, maybe one of the most mismanaged wars in history, they finally did enter Sevastopol, and the war was over.
So why did you decide to use the Crimean War as opposed to any other war for this novel?
I actually started writing a novel about British observers in the American Civil War. And there were about a dozen of them with McClellan, with the Federal Army on the peninsula, and in the beginning of the American Civil War. And I started writing it and began to realize very quickly during the research that these officers had basically gotten their experience and had been made the fine officers that they were 6 years before the American Civil War in the Crimea.
Uh-huh.
And so I made the decision the first book would be about the Crimean War, and it would segue into a sequel that will bring the same characters into the American Civil War. That's actually being written right now.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Okay, so why don't you tell us a little bit about Follow Me to Glory? Give your listeners a synopsis of this story.
I'd be glad to. It involves a young Scottish nobleman named Ian Carlyle, the second son of an earl. I made him a second son just to complicate his life. And he grows up in Victorian Britain and struggles toward manhood with the help of at times, a sultry, beautiful barmaid named Jasmine.
Mm-hmm.
And he's following his dream to lead men in war and find glory. He has to prove his skills and his leadership and his courage in the Crimea. And he also has to come to grips with what the real truth about glory is, and that's not what he expected. This is more about what glory isn't than what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, he discovers the same thing that most warriors discover when they've been in harm's way, and that's that what it really boils down to is comradeship, the commitment to the men that you lead, and just plain ordinary survival.
Mm. Hmm. So Richard Blake, actually a reviewer for us here at Reader Views, I'm going to just tell you a little quote that he said when he reviewed your book. He says, "Hutchison is an entertaining storyteller. He imparts historical information with amazing dexterity and is a powerful motivator. By example, Ian Carlyle inspires the reader to follow their dream, to fulfill their destiny, and to face their circumstances with new courage and confidence." And, you know, those are strong statements for a lead character. And I'd just like to know how you came up with him. I know this is somewhat of a coming-of-age story in Follow Me to Glory in this first book. And if you could maybe also speak a little to how he will evolve through your series.
Well, the character, Ian Carlyle, I had actually a lot of the influence in past books that I've read in the same genre have been about enlisted men who eventually became officers and had to fight the turmoil of having come from enlisted to officer ranks. And I wanted to write a book about a nobleman, an aristocrat who actually was an officer. There are so many fine gentlemen like that in the British Army that don't seem to get the same press as the enlisted man who becomes an officer. But Ian Carlyle is a Scotsman, and I'm a Scotsman.
Oh,
my dad was born in Kilmarnock, Ayrshire, in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
Emigrated to Canada and then to the United States. So my roots are in Scotland. And I wanted to make him a Scottish hero because I wanted him to be a kind of a rogue, a kind of rebel, maverick, if you will, among not only the students at Eton College, where he goes to school, but also among the officers in his regiment. I wanted to give him that Highland spirit. And so I put all of those things together to come up with the character itself. But the history of the individual was done by doing research. And what I did was did research on several of the observers that were with the General McClellan in the Civil War, and I took their service record books and combined them and actually invented a service record for Ian Carlyle based on two or three actual British officers in the Scots Fusilier Guards, which is a very prestigious Scottish regiment. The Guards are, in fact, the elite of the British Army. They are the Queen's Guards, and so they're her personal guard. And it evolved both from that, the research aspect, and from my own personal roots.
Mm, okay. Now, speaking to the research process, you know, you're talking about character development research. What kind of research did you do on the military side of it with the strategical tactics used and that sort of historical research? And how long did you research for this book?
The length of time, actually, I spent almost 3 years researching before I felt I could put pen to paper, but the research was a joy. I'm an investigator by trade, And research to me is like another form of investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent months in the archives of the Scots Fusilier Guards, and at Eton College, I spent two or three weeks at Eton College going into their archives and trying to find stories that I could fit into the storyline of the book, and the characters that it involved, and the photographs of the characters, so that I could actually describe people as opposed to imaginary folks.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, I believe very strongly, if you're writing a historical novel, that you need to walk the walk. And so what I did was I actually walked everywhere Ian Carlyle walked, including the battlefields in the Crimea, on two different occasions where I went over there and saw exactly what he would have seen and the way he would have seen it and from the positions he would have been in. And when I write in the book that that Ian Carlyle hid behind the bank of a stream while artillery fire was raining down in stark terror, there's two things. One is I've actually been to that stream. I've seen that spot. I've been there in order to feel what he felt. And second, it goes back to my own background in a place where I was in harm's way and kind of felt the same way.
Wow, that speaks a lot to the passion you have of this subject matter, you know, going all the way over there to really get in touch with what your character would have felt. That's incredible.
You're very kind.
Yeah, yes. So your passion is, from what I hear, 19th century military history. You've been lecturing on this subject internationally for over 20 years. What is it that draws you to this time, that particular century, and this subject matter?
A different life, Juanita.
Mm.
A different set of values, a different view toward the world and your surroundings, one that perhaps in another life I might have enjoyed being at. And it's a simpler time, I think, and by the same token, a more complex time.
Mm-hmm.
The tactics, they're linear tactics. They're still throwing armies against one another, standing in lines of men 200 yards apart and firing at each other when the weapons have overtaken the tactics and are now effective at a 600-yard range, and so you're getting many, many casualties. And so from the standpoint of war, it's an amazing period of time. From the mores and values of the and culture of the of Britain in the Victorian period, that pretty much stands by itself. It's an amazing period that full of gentlemen, and at that time you couldn't touch a woman unless you had a pair of gloves on.
Oh, is that right?
When you were at a dance, you wore white gloves because you would not reach for the hand of a woman to dance with her unless you were actually wearing the gloves. You would never be seen in public unless you had on at least a vest over the top of your shirt, because your shirt was considered an undershirt.
Mm.
It's a very romantic time, a very different time than we have now, and in many ways a much more simple time.
Simple time. It's interesting to hear you talk about the military strategies that were used back then that seem probably today so archaic. You know, I know you've had an incredible life with a serious lean towards military involvement. What is it like for you to know about the strategies used today in the military and tactics used today compared to what you find back then? And is there any kind of comparisons or differences you can make from that kind of research?
There are actually lots of them. In both aspects, both comparisons and dissimilarities, but I actually taught tactics, small unit tactics, while I was in the Marine Corps, and so to me, studying tactics is fascinating. Their tactics being much simpler, it wasn't until the Civil War when they started actually digging holes and hiding underground because they realized the weapons were more accurate, but it's the similarities that I find, and this is very, very stark and very strong in what I find when I'm doing the research and feel when I'm writing, is that it all boils down to the same thing. No matter whether you're in the 19th century or you're in Vietnam or you're in Iraq, it all boils down to the soldier on the ground who has to get up the courage to be able to move into harm's way and do so that he doesn't put himself in a position where he's going to hurt his fellow soldiers. And to be able to do that is the bottom line, I think, in almost every conflict, every combat. And I find that the same no matter whether you're where I was in Vietnam or whether you're in a stream hiding behind a bank in the Crimea.
Interesting. So what would you say are some of the glaring differences militarily?
What I mentioned, the tactics of throwing armies online against one another, of course, but also the management of the war. We've come leaps and bounds. What comes to mind is medical. The medical problems in the Crimean War caused more casualties than Russian bullets, and thanks to women like Florence Nightingale, there were things done about them, and eventually there were changes made, and that began the whole change in which today, when a soldier is wounded, he's taken care of very, very quickly. In those days, it took 2 weeks just to get him to the hospital because it was in Scutari, 2 weeks away by ship.
Mm-hmm.
And the medical procedures have, of course, changed drastically. There was so much disease in the Crimean War that just doesn't exist today. It, too, took its toll in various ways, like cholera was considered far more dangerous than the Russians. And
wow.
Men were just keeling over in the middle of a march. They'd turn purple and keel over. They'd be talking, and 10 minutes later, they were gone. They were dead.
Wow.
And those are the kinds of differences that I see, is the transport, the ability to get ammunition to the front, the simple ability to get clothing there when the troops needed it. Of course, that could be considered somewhat a similarity today as well, because of Iraq and the problem getting armored vests over there.
Mm-hmm.
could be akin to the same problem in the Crimea, but they had trouble just getting warm clothing to their their men.
I'm sure that was a very cold region in the winter.
And they didn't expect to be there in the winter.
Oh.
So they went there dressed for summer. And then there was a hurricane which sunk ships, and then there were muddy roads, and there were a million reasons, but they had British soldiers dying of starvation and exposure to the elements when food and clothing were only 9 miles away in Balaclava, but they couldn't get it to them.
Oh, wow.
Now, those things have changed drastically.
Yeah.
I mean, of course.
Yes, of course. Now, the Crimean War is actually infamously remembered as a war that was really wrought with military and logistical incompetence, as well as somewhat of a disaster. And, you know, you're telling me about the disease and the starvation, that type of thing. What else made this war such a problem or such a disaster?
The British hadn't actually fought a large war in 40 years at that time, since Waterloo, since the Napoleonic Wars. And they were totally ill-prepared for a full-scale war in every department. Mm. You're talking about transportation, medical, all of the logistics areas, and every aspect of it, they were just plain ill-prepared. But that wasn't all. They also had a problem with the fact that all of their leadership was quite old, because they were the same leaders that were there 40 years ago in the Napoleonic Wars. They were now in their 60s, late 50s and 60s and even 70s. And there were a lot of bad military decisions made. They failed to seize the initiative, follow up. They didn't know how to use cavalry. Their orders were unclear. They generally, the two aspects that I find most drastically different is the real solid British soldier on the ground was doing everything he could do and then some, but he had bad leadership, and he had bad logistics and bad support. And in spite of all that, the British and French soldiers who were there were were doing what they had to do, and they were actually doing it well.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was really boiled down to something very simple. They learned an awful lot in the Napoleonic Wars, but the lessons had been forgotten. And the leader in Britain that was there in the Napoleonic Wars, Wellington, who knew everything and was a great leader, was gone.
Mm-hmm.
He had died. And so there was a huge void in leadership.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Fascinating. Just hearing you speak about it, I mean, you know so much about this time and these wars. It's just fascinating to hear you speak. I'd like to hear you talk a little more about the significance of your title, Follow Me to Glory. You know, it does somewhat suggest a glamorous notion of war. What are your thoughts on that?
I wanted Ian Carlyle, my protagonist, I wanted him to be trying to follow his father's footsteps. His father was at Waterloo and on the staff of Wellington and a hero and in the Scots Fusilier Guards. And to the son, to Ian, what glory meant was leading men in war, just like his father had done.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that today those who send folks to war, those who go to war first, and those who cheer them on, see this word glory that is somehow in their reach and a prize that if they're brave enough or they're lucky enough, somehow they can get this prize. And the reality falls far short of the expectation. And the warriors that fight the dirty, ugly little wars, they know the real truth, and I mentioned that already.
Mm-hmm.
You know that it isn't glory; it's more like kinship and commitment to your men and just survival. But the idea of the book, there were several sub themes, like a coming of age novel and a romance, and there were even some leadership. But the basic theme in the title is, when you go to war, you really go with expectations that are far in advance of what the reality is. And when you get there and find out, you have to make a choice. You either come home safely and get out of the military, or you end up making it a career.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because of glory. It's because of everything else that has to do with humankind.
Mm-hmm. How interesting. So you just mentioned other sub-themes about your book, and I'd really like to talk a little bit about the romantic subplot that you have going on. You know, it really balances out the military focus of your book, and I know you have a funny story about why this romantic subplot is going on. Can you tell listeners about it?
Well, the way I first envisioned, not the way I envisioned it necessarily, but the way I first wrote it in the first draft, Ian was a rather circumspect sort of individual when it came to the opposite sex, and he also had a very, very controlling father and a very protective mother, and he led sort of a sheltered existence, and I hadn't really thought about anything other than moving him into the war, and I went to a restaurant in Gettysburg one night, and I had six of Gettysburg's lovely ladies sitting around at a table who were talking about the book, because I had had them read some parts of it in order to see whether it was worthy.
Mm-hmm.
and they came to this obvious conclusion among them, and that was, if I didn't have a romantic interest in the book, not only weren't they going to buy it, but nobody else would. And so I caved and went home and immediately wrote Jasmine into the book.
Added Jasmine in. And can you tell us who Jasmine is again?
And Jasmine is actually, I say barmaid, but she actually managed the bar in the Victorian era. She couldn't have owned the bar, probably because they just had those kinds of rules.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, she was the one that managed the bar. She's very strong-willed, mysterious, sultry, full of life, kind of like most of the ladies that I've enjoyed in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And she becomes romantically involved with Ian. She teaches Ian a great deal, and she actually meets him a couple of times in the book, and I'm not going to tell you much more because I don't want to give it away.
Don't want to give it away. Oh, you're going to leave us hanging. That's okay. Readers will have to buy your book for more on that. So I would like to hear also about the wider scope of your readership that actually include women also, because, you know, this isn't just, you know, a dry historical fiction. It really is an incredibly full, multi-layered book. And, you know, you add maps in it where you people really, really can get taken into this story. So who do you think will really enjoy or reading your book, and, you know, what's the wider scope of it?
Actually, I've been pleased with the response I've had. The readership seems to be broad in that respect, and I was pleased to find out that the ladies who have read the book have enjoyed it immensely. I think many of them reluctantly they thought, it's a war novel, and we're not inclined to read it. But those who have actually read the book have come back with very kind remarks that indicate that it's appealing to a broad readership. And the interest, I think, for that broad readership is in the fact that it is really a coming of age novel as much as it is a war novel.
Mm-hmm.
The first chapters is a setting of war, but the backstory after that brings Ian Carlyle through many challenges with his family and the British culture and the Scottish culture and Victorian Britain, and then brings him into Eton College, where he has to go through years of college there, and then finally brings him to London, where he's first stationed. He's still not in war, but that's where he actually meets Jasmine, and it goes into London during the Victorian times, and you actually don't get into the war till the last half of the book.
Mm.
And I think that because that flow is in there, it has an appeal to far more than just folks who enjoy a good war novel.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you mentioned that this is a prequel, and your next book will be set in the American Civil War?
Is being set in the American
Civil
War.
Okay, so you're
I'm writing it as we speak.
Okay, great. So, and then there...
it will bring the same Ian Carlyle, the same character, and even some of the other characters that are in the first book will be brought into the American Civil War. And basically, it puts him in the Battle of Antietam with on the staff of General McClellan. And after the Battle of Antietam, he is transferred as a military attaché to the British legation in Washington. He becomes involved in a plot by some profiteering British industrialists, arms dealers, to assassinate President Lincoln.
Wow. Interesting.
And I also plan on a third, but I have not actually decided where I'm going to, the setting for the third novel, but the original thought and still is that this will be a trilogy.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that will all evolve very naturally once you get the second one finished.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any additional research that you had to do for this second one?
Yes, and interesting research, as a matter of fact, because I live in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and the assassination is to take place at the Gettysburg Address. And so I was put in the rather unique position of plotting the assassination of a president in the 19th century in my hometown.
In your hometown. Oh, boy. I bet they'll have a field day with that in the newspapers or, you know, magazines when you come out with that. That's going to be interesting.
And the research for the Civil War that it involves, again, I need to walk the walk. I'm actually doing that at the Battle of Antietam. Several interesting things happened at that battle, and my character will be involved in the in most of them. And the research is easier because, of course, Gettysburg and Antietam are not far away, and the Crimea was, and England is. And so it's easier research, but I find that even though I probably know much more about the Civil War than I did at the time about the Crimean War, I still need to go back and go in depth and do the detailed research. I believe that the challenge of someone who writes historical fiction is to entice the reader, but I also think the challenge is to have a really good story with really good history.
Yes.
And the good history to me means good research, and it also means, and this is something I hope the readers understand above all else, is that first and foremost, it has to be a good story, and the history shouldn't dominate the story. Those little minutiae details that tend to be in some historical novels, I've tried to keep to a minimum so that the history complements the characters and the storyline.
That's a very good point. So was this story brewing around for you, the characters, before you decided which wars to set it in and the time and the settings?
I think the answer would be yes, they were. I think I've had Ian Carlyle in my mind for much longer than I wrote this, but I hadn't actually named him. I knew the character I wanted to put in the book, but I hadn't fleshed it out. And it's been not only a challenge, but a great joy to do this. And it's the first time for me that the challenge in writing a novel, I've written all my life, but the challenge to writing a novel is the narrative and the characters actually speaking to one another and trying to show what's going on through the dialogue, not the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And the dialogue between the folks that are in the story is amazing when you're writing it, because sometimes they take you places you never thought it was going to go.
Yeah.
And your outline ends up in the trash,
yeah.
because your character wants to go somewhere else. And the other thing that's very interesting is, to me, is that you have such total control over what's happening at the same time.
Mm.
So if he starts to go somewhere, you can pull him back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's been fun.
I bet it has. So this actually was your first novel?
This is the first novel, yes.
Yes, okay. I knew that you had done writing before. I didn't know that this actually was your first novel. Well, that's very interesting. I know you have a passion for also reading historical fiction. Who has influenced you? What authors do you really enjoy reading?
Probably the most influence on what I'm currently writing would be C.S. Forrester's Hornblower series, Bernard Cornwell's Sharp series, especially Patrick O'Brien and the Jack Aubrey series, like Master and Commander. And, you know, the influence on me, and I said before that I think a historical novel, I think its job in history is to entice people. It's like a gateway to history.
Mm-hmm.
It opens the door for something else. And for me, I wouldn't be a historian today if it hadn't been for the Red Badge of Courage that I got when I was 10 years old and read probably 15 times. And that's what enticed me to look more deeply into history. And and so that Stephen Crane is definitely an influence.
Mm. You know, I was wondering, and I wanted to ask you as well, when did all of this interest in the military history? I mean, your life is so integrated with it. When did it all start? And, you know, thinking that there must have been some kind of inspiration at a young age. So was it just a book, or was it something?
It wasn't just a book.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
I think it goes back to when I was, like, I don't know, 12 years old with a wooden gun playing war in a local park with some of my friends. I think I'd be hard-pressed to know exactly when it happened, but I know that all my life, from the beginning, I knew that I was probably destined to go into the military.
Mm.
And after 26 years in the military, I still felt exactly the same way.
So, wow. It never changed.
No.
Interesting. So I know that Follow Me to Glory has won a bronze award at the Independent Publishers Awards for 2007, and also I believe that was in the Best Regional Fiction category, and you're also a finalist in the upcoming 2007 Forward Magazine Book of the Year Awards?
That's correct. It was both surprising and pleasing to me, and And I can also say that I've been very, very pleased with the reviews I've had so far.
Absolutely, yes. You're getting fantastic reviews. And for a first novel, I mean, this kind of recognition must feel incredible to you.
Yes, even my publisher's happy, which is always a good thing.
Oh, yes, that is always a good thing. Keep them happy and everyone else is happy. Well, that's great. So how can readers and listeners find out more about you and Follow Me to Glory?
I have a website, and The website, first of all, gives them a great deal of information, but also leads them directly to a way to purchase the book.
Oh, great.
And the website is www.followmetoglory.com.
Great.
And I try to keep it as simple as possible, and it so far has worked. It worked very well.
Simple is better when it comes to websites. That's
great.
Yes. So
it's also available in select bookstores around the country and in the United Kingdom.
Great.
I've had a great deal of very, very nice response from the United Kingdom. The book's been endorsed by the Crimean War Research Society.
Mm.
It's been endorsed by the Scots Guards. It's on their website. Several of the bookstores in London and around the various regimental museums in and about the United Kingdom are carrying the book. And I've had one book signing tour over there where I signed in Edinburgh at the Royal Scots Club and also down in Wellington Barracks in London.
That is some incredible recognition for your book. That must just be overwhelming to you.
It's very, very nice.
Yes, yes. When was your book signing tour over there?
It was in the month of April.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you plan on going back at any time?
I believe I'll be going back there again this year and probably a couple of times next year. The audience for the book, because it is a British war, is as much there as it is here. I find that they find it amusing that an American, that a Yank, was writing a book about a British officer of Scottish descent in a British war.
Right, right.
But again, the response has been very gratifying.
So what are you finding the comments over there? What are people appreciating about this book? Is it the military aspect? Is it the whole story with Ian Carlyle? Is there any differences between your fans here and then the Europeans?
The British, Scottish, Irish, Welsh fans ask a lot more questions because they know a lot more about it. For some reason, they seem to ask more questions about it. I'm not sure why that is, but they do.
Mm-hmm.
The questions I get from readers here are more in how I wrote the book than they are about the Crimean War, oddly enough. And the questions I get over there are, how did you do the research and what did you think about certain aspects of the Crimean War? And they too are very, very good questions. And so I'm getting a slight different response from the two different audiences.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, we wish you much success. This Follow Me to Glory is a great book. We certainly encourage listeners to go to your website to learn more about you and this book and your upcoming endeavors. And when can we expect the second book to come out?
Later this year or very early next year.
Oh, great. So you're probably halfway through it at this point.
Pretty close.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, it has been fantastic talking with you. And I want to offer you just the final minute here to share any thoughts that you have, any final thoughts.
Well, first I'd like to thank you, Juanita, for giving me the opportunity.
Sure.
And once again, it's my fond hope and will be for the second book as well, is that my readers enjoy reading it as much as I've enjoyed writing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a journey that was full of challenges, and the challenges are what make it interesting, and I find that this part of my life, the writing part of my life, is very fulfilling, and I intend to keep it up. So I hope that the readers out there are as interested in me keeping it up as I am.
Absolutely. Well, from the reviews I've been reading and the recognition that you're getting, I know that you're going to have a very successful writing career in the future. So best to you.
Thank you.
All right, Will. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. All right, listeners, as Will had mentioned, you can purchase Follow Me to Glory at his website at www.followmetoglory.com. As well as Will said, you can purchase his book through local and online booksellers, and it's now available at select bookstores in the UK. For a recent book review and online interview, you can also go to readerviews.com. So I hope you have enjoyed this interview today. I certainly have. Thank you so much for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.